Hello and welcome to a special Humans Invent cycling podcast. I'm Richard Moore, and in December 2013, I hosted an event with David Miller of Garmin Sharp at the Institute of Contemporary Arts in London, in which he looked back on his career and ahead to his final season as a professional cyclist. Also taking part in the conversation was Finlay Pretzel of the Scottish Documentary Institute. Finlay is making a film about Miller in 2014, and for more information about this and to find out how to get involved, see davidmillerfilm.com. But we started off talking about another of Finlay's films, Standing Start, with the track cyclist Craig McLean. It was this film and David's reaction to it that has led to his collaboration with Finlay. And so we start by hearing from David and what he made of Standing Start when he first watched it in 2007.
And often I'd find myself in my own apartment and I'd always put this on. And I'd put it on with my headphones and just sit there and watch it. Because it was the first time, and you have to understand, for me, watching track cycling, I'm a road racer. Track cycling, for me, I'd done in 2004 when I was in my kind of build-up to maybe do the Athens Olympics. I was terrified of the track. The track, for me, was so scary. So, like, kind of, when it came on and all the tension at the beginning, I was like, oh, I remember that. That was, like, terrifying seeing the boards. And then when it kicks off and you get this massive sound and all the sound, and it just felt like that's exactly what it felt like when I was on the track. And then all of a sudden with the narration, and I was like, this is incredibly visceral. And I watched it over and over again, and it kept thinking, this is how it felt. This is like, I just kept watching because I loved it. And then the narration, then that glimmer of me where it happened to be in the narration where it's like, I'll go. And it's like, because I'm always like that with my team. It's like when the chips are down, I'm always the guy, I'll go. Like a fool, like, but you need to attack first, I'll go.
That was a total mistake by the editor. It was this happy mistake. He kind of cut this thing and said, oh, have a look. And he didn't know anything about David. And it was that point he says,
some men have nothing.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's this picture of David. And when we told him that, he was quite excited, not David, the editor, because it was a total mistake. And, you know.
Yeah, and it was the time when I had nothing. So it's like I saw this kind of flash on the screen. I was like, there's nothing, I'll go. And it was just the first time for me I'd seen a film about cycling, and watching again, I don't ever get tired of it. It's kind of, I never get tired of it, because as a pro cyclist, it does feel like being a racing cyclist. And now watching again, after now spending months in the movie industry and going to editing rooms, all of it, I can see everything that's gone into it, and it seems clever. And I do think it's a very good film, and it does, as for me, a pro bike racer, I think it does capture what being a bike racer is, even if you're not a track cyclist.
Well, we'll talk in a minute about, you know, what about how you intend to collaborate, but Finlay, maybe you can answer this question first, because it occurs to me watching the film, Craig is very physical. You mentioned the drumming, the weight, the lifting the weights, the effort itself. It's a very physical film. David used the word visceral, which we're going to try and avoid using tonight. But it's a very physical. He's a very physical guy. That's how he expresses himself. David strikes me as quite different. He kind of. I mean, David, if you let me finish.
He's strong. I mean, he's got muscles, man.
You're fairly physical as well. But
take my glasses off.
What I mean
off.
Is because road cycling. Hey, track. Oh, that's fair. Track cycling is all about raw power. Road cycling is all about suffering, and the psychological aspect of it is so important. Mm. And that's, I guess, the challenge. And so it's quite a different film that you want to try and make with David. And I just wonder how you'll overcome that challenge.
Well, I think that was I think originally I wanted to capture the road side of it. To be honest, I'd never had any experience racing on a track. I was a mountain biker and did lots of kind of road cycling, so I kind of had much more an understanding of the endurance side of it. But at that point, you think, how do you capture that world? It was difficult enough getting into the velodrome, and with the help of, like, you know, James Pope and the Revolution events, that's what really gave us such a kind of background, lot of, you know, footage and research, to be honest. And I think I've lost the chain of thought, actually, slightly.
How do you make a film about a road cyclist?
Yeah. So, of course, that one. I told you not to ask me that one. No, it was really capturing that. And how do you do it is a completely, it's a difficult It's a difficult thing to do. When we were shooting Stand and Start, I think I'd followed David's career since he started, really, and I'd not forgotten about him, but he had his band, came back, and it was actually shooting Stand and Start that I kind of noticed, I hadn't probably noticed before, is this kind of, this graceful, elegant style of riding a bike. And on the track, compared to all these other track cyclists, he stood out immediately. And I think that was a kind of sense of, possibly he could, possibly be eventually, this is the only other bike film I want to make, is about David, with David.
And why do you want to do it, David?
Well, because it's I love cycling. I mean, I love cycling. I'm a racer. I've been a racer since I was a teenager, and I love racing, and I love the training, and I love everything about it. But I'm 36 years old, and I've been doing this since I was, essentially, I've been professional since I was 18. It's my whole life. It's my family's life. It's everything that I do is pivots around cycling. And I wrote my book because I wanted to write a book. I spent my whole 20s reading books, and I felt that I needed to tell my whole story, and I wanted to make it a good book. That's David Luxman and Jeremy Whittle, who are the two men who helped me do it. They said, well, if you do this, and they were always the ones that were like, you should do this, but you do it when you feel you should do it. But if you do it, it has to be able to stand on that bookshelf 15 years from now, and you look at it and you say, I'm proud of that. And it captures moment. And there's something that the reason I wrote the book was because I didn't think that book existed. I didn't think for my peers, for my colleagues to read a book and share it to their, like Christian Vandervelde gave it to his mum and said, Mum, read this. And with the film, I watched this and I was like, well, that's the first time I've seen somebody capture what being a racer is like. And then Finlay and I have had this dialogue, this rapport that's gone beyond that for 6-7 years now in total. And I want us to create a film that nobody's ever seen before, that my colleagues will respect and will tell their friends to watch and their family to watch. And I want it to be something that years down the line, so say 15 years down the line, it will be a film that stands the test of time, that you can watch it and go, oh, that's what professional bike racing is. Because I think we've lost track of that of late. We've got so much wrapped up in the melodrama and the soap opera and the peripheral information and the stories that go on, which are fascinating. Believe me, I'm the first person that goes on the internet to see who's being caught, what's going on, what's the drama. And that's what cycling has become. We've almost lost track of what racing is. And the reason I got into bike racing was because I think it's a beautiful sport, and I know it's a beautiful sport, and I'd like to be able to share that as a bike racer. And I think Finlay can capture that. I think we can create a film that nobody's ever seen before, that you watch it and go, you finish it and say, that's what pro bike racing is. And I think that would be fascinating. I think it would be a lovely thing to do, and it would be lovely for me at the end of my career to bookend my career with that, kind of a thank you and a goodbye and a, like, this is what pro bike racing was for me.
Well, you mentioned the 18-year-old you there who went off to France, and we're here in the ICA, and one of the stories about you is that you had this choice to make between going to France and trying to become a professional cyclist or going to art college. And here you are, you've sold out the ICA. I bet, had you been an artist, I bet you'd never have done that. That could be the second insult, but it's not. I'm sure you'd have sold out many
100%
times.
100%, if I was an artist, David, I would not have sold out the ICA.
Well, this is a story that we don't...
No, but that's actually the bottom line. I knew, even at 18, I wasn't a good artist. I was good at drawing stuff. I was good at painting. I was good at replicating things. I had not an artistic bone in my body regard being bonkers creative and doing mad things. I was very clinical in the things I did. And so I recognized that I wasn't an artist. And if I had... And I knew I loved cycling and I was good at it. And at the time, it wasn't we didn't have academy programs. We didn't have a kind of a system to nurture young talent. I had to rely on my mum to take me to races, sell her car to buy me a car so that I could go to France and have the Dave Rayner Fund fund me and have people who were passionate to help me. There wasn't a fast track. There wasn't anything. So it was very much for me, cycling was the sane option.
Wow. I mean, you know, casting your mind back, though, to that that boy that you were, and here we sit on the eve of your retirement season. Could you have imagined, you know, half your life you've been a professional bike rider, basically? I mean, could you have envisaged that, you know, you would have had the career that you've had back then?
No, I don't think. I've only actually reckoned, the reason I think I've decided to stop racing next year is because I have realised it for the first time. I'd never realised it before. I never realised what I'd done, where I'd been. I kind of was always in the moment 100%. And it was this year kind of that I actually thought, oh, shit, I'm 36. And it wasn't a case of me spending my kind of a certain period. I grew up being a professional cyclist. I was an adolescent until I was 25, 26. I kind of grew up doing these things. I became world champion doping as a kid. I got banned as a kid. I kind of then grew up. I very much matured a lot later kind of through all these things. And it's only now, as an adult, I've thought, oh, wait, hang on, stop. You need to kind of do something else, move on. And it's not because I love it more than ever, but I don't want to watch myself become shit at it.
No, I'm not going to add a third insult there, because you've got a final year to go, and I know training is going very, very well at the moment. But, David, Finlay mentioned that Craig was quite an edgy sort of guy, who didn't always fit all that well into the British cycling system. And what we have now is this kind of well-oiled machine. Had you been an 18-year-old kid now, could you have seen yourself growing up in that machine, being part of that system, being a team Sky man, do you think?
Yeah, as an 18-year-old, I'd have loved it. I was so clinical. I was such a perfectionist, and I was so disciplined and organized, and I would have fitted into the Sky system 100% when I was 18. Unfortunately, or 19, even as 19, I went across to France and then took a different track. And because of the person I am and the way my personality and mind operates, I kind of I fit in, and I maneuver, and I kind of learn, and I adapt to situations I'm in. But as a post Hong Kong adolescent young man, I was so driven, focused, clinical. I was against the grain 100%. When I was 18, I was paying a coach money to coach me. I would have my facts delivered to the team president in France, and they all laughed at me. And I had my diets, and you know, I was incredibly anal and perfectionist, and that just kind of slowly just disappeared the more professional I became, oddly.
Yeah. Well, it is funny, because you did sort of lose yourself for a while, and you mentioned that you read books throughout your 20s. I remember coming and interviewing you in 2002, which is probably one of your books called Racing Through the Dark. That was probably one of the darkest periods in a way. Nobody knew that at the time. But you know, one of the interesting things you told me when I did come in and see you was that you'd stopped reading books, you'd stopped listening to music, you lost all those extra other interests that you had. And has regaining those interests and wanting to be involved with this film, writing your book, you know, do you feel like you've kind of reconnected with yourself in a way?
In a way, kind of yes and no. I mean, I love books. I don't go to art galleries. I don't go and look at stuff. I'm pretty lazy regards thing. I don't really listen to that much music anymore. My curiosity is different now. When I was in my early 20s, the reason I read so many books was because I was so insecure about being in an environment where nobody read books. Nobody read books. Nobody watched films. Nobody listened to music. It was all so kind of basic, my experience as a young professional cyclist. There was nothing interesting about it. It was just weird. And so I very much went off the opposite direction, which kind of I tend to do. But I learned so much from doing that. And where I am today is I'm very privileged. I'm such a wonderful... I base most of what I do now on the people kind of that I spend time with and the books I've read and being able to do these things and watch things. And I have very clear... I don't need to look so hard. I used to spend my whole early 20s searching, looking, reading everything, checking out, listening to everything, looking at art as well. I kind of know exactly what I like now, and I kind of stick to that. It's a kind of very different. I don't tend to, like, I have Richard Williams here, and who's a journalist who literally has passions for everything, which is something that I admire massively, because I kind of end up fixing on one passion and do that for 6 months, go on to another one. And I look at Richard and think, Christ, Richard has F1, has blues music, has, could go into politics, could speak about anything, film. And those are the people kind of that I always think, oh, that's those are the people I kind of love.
You're putting a lot of pressure on Richard to ask a really good question later when we open it up to questions. It's funny that you should say that, because I remember speaking to Craig McLean in the early stages of you working with him about the idea of the film, and I said, have you seen the film Zidane, A 21st Century Portrait? Because that was one of the influences. And he went, no, I've not seen it, but it sounds like arty-farty bollocks. and my impression was always that wouldn't have been David's reaction. But David... A few of us were in the bar area earlier, in a kind of gallery of old jerseys of yours throughout your career, and the rest of you can probably wander through there later and have a look at them. And I wondered, looking at those jerseys, is there one that you would like to pick out as one that evokes special kind of happy memories for you?
I said to me, when you asked me that before, you said, is there one here? Immediately it's Toile de Pana, and it's this white jersey that sits in the corner, kind of hidden away, because I think Rebecca was hanging them up. I thought, what the fuck is this jersey? So it's kind of in the corner. And 3 days of De Panne is this race in West Belgium on the coast, Coxeter. And it's the dirtiest, most horrific race. Or even all the professionals hate it. It happens in the week, the Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday preceding Flanders. And it's, you go there and... If you finish it without a crash, you've had a good time. It's like it's that within 5Ks of the first stage, people are jumping onto pavements, dodging lampposts. It's just carnage. And I won that overall, and I remember thinking, that's like the pro race. Like, when you win De Panne, like, you got so much respect, 'cause it takes such an arsenal of kind of weaponry to be able to, like, handle your bike, manage the peloton, kind of... weather the echelons, the bad weather, win the time trial, do these things. And it's like, that for me is my favorite jersey, because it's like all the pros are like, yeah, De Panne.
And there's a Tour de France yellow jersey out there as well.
Yeah, De Panne though. It's like it's all the pros are like, De Panne. De Panne. You went there? You survived?
That was the 2010, I think, wasn't it? When you did have a really good little flourish in the classics that year. And I know you want to... go back there and kind of do that again next year, don't you?
Yeah, I do love it. I mean, that's where I fell in. That's where my mum, when I had the choice of, when I asked my mum if I could defer my art college place for 1 year, I was telling her I was going to go to Belgium and race kermesses. And it was, I loved racing in Belgium. I loved kind of the brutal sort of like proper bike racing. It was just carnage. It's like dog eat dog. And I kind of lost that. I got into time trialing. I love time trialing, and I kind of got into stage racing because it was what I was good at, and I was quite good at managing my career and figuring out how I fit in the team and what helped the team, my sponsors, and what was clinical. But my first love is road racing. It always has been. And the best road racing you get is Flanders. It's just nuts. It's just proper bike racing.
And the obvious follow-up question is, what is the jersey that evokes the most unhappy memories, or have you shredded all of them? Any of them survive up there?
No, the pink jersey doesn't. It's not unhappy. It's just memories. It's like that jersey was kind of the weirdest thing. It was I won that. I got that the day that
Walter Wayland.
Yeah,
died.
Walter died, and it was kind of the oddest thing, because I finished the stage and I was so pissed off when I finished the stage, because I'd wanted to win it, and I'd already got pissed off 8Ks before because I fought an attack, and I was waiting for them to get tired, and I went to put in my big ring, couldn't get my big ring, couldn't get it in, got caught by the group, because I was using those isometric rings, it didn't work for shit, and I couldn't get on the big ring, and so I got caught, like, pushing, couldn't attack, the group went, and I sat there in the peloton, and my teammate was in the break of five riders or something, And I was like, well, that's it. I've lost the stage. It was 10Ks to go at this point. And I thought, fuck it. I'm going to go. And we got to this little, it was like this little coast. And I left the peloton. And I was with Contador. And I came by Contador and I looked at him and he looked at me. And he kind of just like looked at me and I kind of could read. He was like, go. And I was like, I'm going. And I went and no one followed me. And Contador kind of covered me and let me go. And I bridged across to the group, and then we raced down, and I thought, fuck, I got this dialed. I'm going to win this for sure. Got there, got my teammate, and I was like, Christoph, lead me out. We got this. And we'd been told that the last corner was like 100 meters to go, so just had to get into that first. Ended up that it was 300 meters to go, so I came around there first. The guy on my wheel was like, got this done. He beat me. And so I crossed the line, and I remember crossing the line, and immediately on my radio going, who the fuck told us we had 100 meters to go? And I was fucking, being a real prima donna, got to the bus, angry, pissed off, sat down, and my phone's ringing. First thing I do is check my phone to see if like Nicola called or anything, see what's going on. And Matt White, who is my director, who was banned by our team for his past, for usual shit. He was ringing, and it was like, and I picked the phone. He's like, Dave, you're in pink. I've worked it out because he's such a kind of fanatic. He follows every single bike race in the world, just loves it. And he's like, you're in pink. And I'd never even crossed my mind that I'd go into pink. And I was like, fuck, I had no way. And I was like, hung up. And then somebody comes in and says, there's been a big crash. And then Nicole calls and goes, have you seen? And I was like, what? There's a guy, he's down, and it looks like he's dead. She's crying. And I'm like, oh, fuck. And then I hear it's Walter Waylands, who, one of my best friends in the team, Tyler Farrett, it is his best friend. Like, literally, they're just like two kids. They're always on WhatsApp, doing their shit, going, they hang out, they live in Ghent together, they do their stuff. And so I'm sitting on the bus, and I'm just like, okay, lost the stage. Now I've got the pink jersey. Walter Waylands, it looks like he's going to die. Then Tyler comes on the bus, and he already knows stuff's going on. And then within 15 minutes, they've already announced that he's dead. And then I go back to the back of the bus, and Tyler's just sitting in the back, crying. And I'm like, you don't say anything. And then my director comes in and says, David, we've got to go. I was like, what for? Is that the pink jersey? I was like, what? He's like, yeah, you got the pink jersey. So I come out, and everyone's just like, obviously everyone's just morose. And I go through. As I get to the podium, they're taking down the podium. I just go to doping control and just sit there. And then somebody about 20 minutes later comes up and says, can you try this on, please? I was like, yeah, it was a pink jersey. I tried it on. I was like, yeah, it fits. Okay. And they took it away. And it was like, and that was me completing my kind of collection of three leaders' jerseys of all three Grand Tours. And it was like the one thing I'd always wanted to do was to have all three Grand Tour jerseys have on my wall one day. And I was like, fuck, I was like, nah. And then I spent that whole evening with Tyler in his room, just sitting there. I got room service, we sat together. I got him wine, and he sat there and he got drunk on his own. And I just remember thinking, well, and the whole day led the peloton, and then I was just so tired. The 2 days after when I lost it, when I crashed, and it was. So the pink jersey is kind of my jersey that has got the most memories.
The Humans Invent Cycling Podcast, interviews and analysis. We've got the big talking points covered.
Can you tell us perhaps about the hardest day that you've ever had physically in a bike race?
Yeah, I wrote about it in my book. It was the Madeleine stage in the Tour de France in 2010. And it was kind of, it had already been a shitty tour, but I'd been on reasonably heavy painkillers up to then, which were kind of dulling everything. And I thought, well, I'm feeling better now. It was a day after the rest day. I won't take the painkillers. And within 15 minutes of the stage, I knew that was a terrible mistake. And it was one of the biggest mountain stages of the tour. And I think we had three big alpine climbs. We had this little one before we hit the Colombier. Because what you don't see, you see the stage and you watch it unfold on TV. The beginning bit is the hardest when we're racing full gas for the break to form. And we were coming over this small, it wasn't even categorized before we got to the climb, and I found myself just dropping through the bunch. And I just thought, oh no, this is going to be a bad day. And I managed to just hang on as we got over the top, got back on the stairs, moved up as far as I could, then we hit the Colombier, which was the first big climb of the day, and I was pop out the back, and I was dropping through the convoy. And here's where it kind of gets weird. So I'm there suffering in the middle of the cars, just trying to just limit the damage, thinking, okay, it's 18K to the top, just find a pace and just limit the damage. People are going to get dropped, you can catch them, get back on. And I see Ryder drop back, stop and have a piss. And Ryder's just unclipped to the side of the road, just having a piss, because it's so easy for him, because it's just like, fine. And then he's like, and I'm just like, Ryder hasn't even seen that I'm dropped. So he's then coming back up afterwards, comes by me, thinks that I've dropped back to help him get back on. And he gets up to me like, just like, all right, Miller time. That's what he says, all right, Miller time, let's go. I'm like, Ryder, I'm not going anywhere, man. He's like, what? I'm like, yeah. I'm going back. He's like, oh, fuck. And so then he realizes that, then we hear, because motorbikes are always dropping by in car, and you hear always, it's always the policeman, the gendarme who are always coming by, their radios are always on full gas, so you hear everything. And we literally hear at the front, attack Darmstrong! And it was like, oh, shit. And Ryder's like, see me, it took him 15Ks to get back onto the front of the bunch. And I was just going back the whole time. And then I spent, this was 180Ks to go, and I spent the whole day on my own with no, like, with the whole convoy. And because it was quite a big name, I had TV motorbike with me the whole time, and you couldn't do the usual kind of charity cheating, like holding onto a bottle or just like a little bit of help here and there. It was just like, persevere, just go. Even my team had given up on me. It was just a disaster.
I have a little sort of postscript to that, because I spotted your... It's very unusual for a rider to finish in a mountain stage like that so far behind the gruppetto and not be eliminated. And it was quite... To see your name on the finish sheet that night, on the results sheet, 7 minutes or 8 minutes or something behind the second last man. So I went to the Garmin Sharp team bus the next morning, and I was waiting for David to find out what the story had been, and a gendarme appeared. And I thought, oh dear, a gendarme for David Miller. And this sounds familiar. He was waiting for David. I was waiting for David, but he seemed very jovial. He wasn't there to arrest him or anything. And David eventually appeared and warmly embraced this guy and had a chat with him, and then disappeared into the bus. Came back out with a jersey that you signed for him, and that was the gendarme that had accompanied you all day on the motorbike.
Yeah, all day, because I've been the last man on the road. I had the convoy behind me, the broom wagon, the ambulance, some service cars, media motorbikes. But one gendarme that was kind of designated to then lead me through everything. So he'd spent 4 hours with me, just in front, not motorbike, but it happened twice. He dropped back beside me and handed me his water bottle and gave it to me. And he knew I was getting bottles, but he let me, he kind of go, no, have a drink. So I had to, then he'd buzz off like 70 meters in front of me. But then the funny thing is, when we got to the top of the climb, the Madeleine, I started racing back down because I knew I could probably make time back up from the descent. And he started going nuts and clearing and honking, and like he was scraping the whole motorbike on the road and clearing everybody and getting really kind of involved with my pursuit back on. We like became this kind of like non-verbal team that whole day. For like, we spent in total 5 hours together, just me looking at him. And so the next day I asked the kind of, I'd spoken to the boss at Tour de France to find out who the head of police was, to find out who the policeman had been who'd escorted me, and I got a jersey, the jersey I'd worn the day before with the numbers, and had it written and signed and dedicated to him, and said in French, thank you for saving my Tour de France.
I mentioned the gruppetto, David. Can you tell us a little bit about life in the gruppetto and how the gruppetto works?
It's a group you tend... What's the funny thing is, the gruppetto is existing less and less in professional cycling. What would happen even a few years, or even 2 or 3 years ago, what would happen is a peloton starts, and if it's a hard stage, there's a number of members of each team who know they can't finish at the front. So they'll make an executive decision, and they're the leader, the kind of the super domestiques of each team. And they'll say, okay, they'll work out all the calculations and go, okay, we need to finish today 6 hours, 15 hours. Okay, we've got 35 minutes today. So they say, we have to hang on for grim death until the penultimate climb. Then we can let go. And then it's like, okay. And everyone's just like, okay. And then, so normally you'd have three or four of those guys from each, like these charismatic guys from other teams, and your team or something would say, when you got to that penultimate climb, you'd see them suddenly drop back and go, Gruppetto! And everyone would go, okay. So this group would form. Now what happens is, nobody forms Gruppetto. Everyone hangs on. So you'll have occasionally a couple of guys with a Gruppetto, and you kind of look around and go, no one's giving up. And so it's like, no, hang on. Because the power of the Gruppetto was, if you stuck together, there's a rule that also says if there's more than 40% of the peloton together, it doesn't matter if you're outside the time limit. But also, if you have the power of numbers, if you're a big group that got dropped on a climb, you would then descend, because normally the guys in the Gruppetto can descend faster than the climbers, because they're bigger guys and they're technically more gifted. They can take time back on the descent, so they come back down to the valley, and instead of faffing around like they've been doing at the front of the race, making tactical decisions like you see on TV, you watch TV and you're like, why aren't they riding? Where are their teammates? So they're faffing around at the front. Behind, you've got 20 minutes behind, 40 guys going through and off, vroom, 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 trying to make time back up in that valley. They hit the climb. They're like, let's just find our pace back up, race like crazy banshees down the descent, hit the valley, go like nutters. And they end up being only 30 minutes behind the climbers at the finish. So the Gruppetto is very much, it was a power of numbers. Now what happens is you have groups of 8 guys, 10 guys, and it doesn't work the same. So people are getting eliminated all the time. There's no solidarity.
Is it just simply that the solidarity is gone?
I think the hierarchy is gone. I think we're in a very transitional period, and the peloton's going through a transitional period. There's obviously the younger guys have no respect for the older guys because the older guys have made errors in the past. So if an older guy says Gruppetto, why would they listen?
Did you have respect for the older guys when you were a younger guy?
Yeah, I was scared of them.
David, next year is your final year. What are your plans for next year and beyond as well?
And next year is basically, I'd like to be in my kind of ideal racing season. The similar program to what I've had over however many years it is, it's kind of, I tend to not be so good at the beginning of the year. I'd love to do well in the classics for the reasons I said before, because I kind of just have so much fun racing in Flanders and Belgium, because it's just so out of my comfort zone and they're all fucking mad. And then going to the Tour de France and having a great Tour de France and wanting to win a stage. Then go to the Commi Games and race in Glasgow. And probably if I could, one of the biggest wins of my career to win the road race. Then, oddly, I kind of had the choice of doing Tour of Britain or the Vuelta a España. I kind of, as a pro cyclist, I'd love to do the Vuelta a España because it's a race I haven't done in years. And it's one of the races I love the most in the world. And I'd love to go and do the Vuelta and then do the Worlds in Spain and finish in the Worlds in Spain and call it a day there.
How would you like to be remembered as a cyclist?
As just a good pro cyclist, I guess. That's it. Yeah, just to be remembered as a good pro cyclist. Yeah, Miller is a really good pro cyclist.
No, it's something else, because you know your career has been sort of divided in two. There's first part and second part.
I think I've been very much a bridge between two generations in a way. But at the same time, when it comes, if it's just in the pure essence, when all this is kind of, we kind of grow through all this and we understand it all and everything I've been through and kind of all this stupid mistakes I made and all those things, it would be lovely. And that's my answer to the question. I would love to be remembered as, yeah, he was a really good pro cyclist. That's what I'd love to be remembered as. It probably won't be. It'll be ex-doper Miller. He was a great advocate, a great anti-doping crusader, did all these things. But I would love to be remembered as being a really good pro cyclist.
And beyond next year, what are your plans? Do you want to stay in the sport? What do you see yourself doing?
Yeah, I'll stay in cycling. I mean, cycling's my life. It's all I know. Pro cycling, I'd like to stay in a much more grassroots level, kind of work with younger guys, not be on the circuit, not dealing with all the political bullshit and having to deal with... I will not continue that one.
So we're going to open up to questions very, very soon. But Finlay, you know, we've talked a lot about what it's like to be a pro cyclist. How are you going to, you know, how are you going to structure this film? What kind of story are you going to tell? You know, how are you going to capture some of these elements that we've talked about?
It's never going to be a biopic. It's never something I or David really wanted to do. It's almost extremely simple and simplistic that all I want to do is capture that feeling of being a professional cyclist. And I think that it sounds extremely simple, but I think I would like to keep it in that microcosm of the racing world. We don't want to see David at home or all the kind of the other elements that go into who he is. I think I want to understand David through in being immersed in that cycling world, in the hotel room, and overhear conversations between him and his teammates, understand the sport from David's point of view. And I think we all know about Lance Armstrong, we know about all the winners, Wiggins, all the rest of it, but it's what David's role within that, and that's a key role. And I think that's what I want to kind of explore, and it's that the mentality to do it, I think, is
how about the filming, Finlay? Because we were talking earlier about how cycling broadcasting is not really developed an awful lot, you know, in the way that other sports perhaps has, with player cam or, you know, cameras in the peloton. How, you know, I know again that Zidane film is quite an influential one where they had lots of cameras all around the ground. How are you gonna film the sport and David?
Yeah, well, we've got a kind of really good relationship with RCS, the kind of organizer of the Giro d'Italia and Tirreno Adriatico, as Sonia was saying before. And they give us quite privileged access with motorbikes on course. We're talking to UCI about using onboard cameras with David and the rest of it. It's all not guaranteed. It's the kind of cycling world. It's this, everything's possibly, yeah, you can do that, but we'll have to see. And it's all, everything's like that. And I think it's a kind of crucial year for us this year in what we've done to test everything. And there's not a, it's not like Premiership football, which is like a fine, you know, restricted, 100% restrictions. It's kind of, there is ways to get around it. And I think that's what we've really tried hard to do, is kind of get within the sport and, you know, and hopefully we can pull that off. I mean, it's documentary at the end of the day, and there's a lot of uncertainties, of course, but I think whatever happens at the end of this year, we'll have some kind of film.
You're listening to the Humans Invent Cycling Podcast, powered by Sharp.
Any questions, please?
David, just very interested in your perspective. We seem to be on the verge of cycling becoming a sport with increasing popularity. It's on TV much more than it was. We've seen the Lycra storm the last couple of years. The roads are just full of cyclists at weekends and so forth. Meanwhile, sponsors are falling away in the Conti teams, the pro teams. Changes maybe Brian Cookson's going to make in terms of the World Tour organisation. What's your view about how it's going to evolve?
The reason this is happening is because it is evolving. What's happening now is we're having a shift. The sport is changing, the economics of the sport are changing, even the governance of the sport has changed. And so it's kind of normal that there is trauma regards sponsorship and trauma regards that level of the sport. But I think it's good. I think it all represents change. The sport as itself is incredibly resilient, and it will survive, and it will be, and it, oddly, it's getting bigger and bigger, but it is changing. So it's going to be 5 years from now a different sport. The most important thing now is it is an anti-doping sport. You can win the Tour de France clean. You can win the biggest one-day races in the clean. So there's a sad irony to the fact that it is in this difficult period of sponsorship, because for the first time in its life, cycling is a good sport.
So I grew up watching pro cycling in the 80s, well, reading Winning magazine, really, and it seemed like a really political sort of system, which I actually quite like. I found it fascinating because you didn't see it in the other sports. They had the patron system with Eno and Kelly and then Bonnier or whatever, And then you had Armstrong, and that seemed quite sort of full-on and domineering or whatever. Are the patrons now, because, well, I was going to ask that of you, David, because when Wouter died, it seemed like you became a patron, and you suddenly became a figurehead that led the peloton. Did you feel that way, and do you think you are a patron, and if not, who is?
The relationship between that role of patron has changed. Patron in the past was very much a boss of the peloton, kind of an alpha male who operated the tribe. I don't know, the reason I kind of have an influence is because of where I've been through, and if I choose to, it's because I can happily go and speak to the organizer of the race, and Christian Prudhomme, or I've got relationships with the bosses of races, and so for me it's much more a different thing. But a patron doesn't work anymore because we don't have that tribal mentality so much. The patron worked so well in the 80s and for the whole history of the sport because the peloton was a pack, like a pack of dogs, and they needed an alpha dog. Now the peloton is very much lots of different micro packs within it, and each one of them, if they're lucky, they have an alpha dog within that micro pack. Most of them don't. It's become very much literally dog eat dog. So in a sense, the sport is changing for the better in many ways, and not the peloton had a sort of a natural state. It had a boss, and that's how it operated, and it was an organic entity. Now very much the sport is cleaner than it's ever been, and it's more ruthless than it's ever been. The peloton, you have no friends anymore. Is that really a better thing? The only way it will survive, the only way the sport, it's made the reason it exists, and that exists, the peloton, the group etta, because that's how it operates. And it will go back to that again in 5 years, 10 years, once the young guys now become older guys. It's just natural that they'll then start to lead the peloton. But we have a difficult transitional period at the moment where the older guys, the younger guys are like, I'm not listening to you. So then they're like, well, I'm not listening to you. So it's very much a kind of the pelotons are very much free electrons at the moment. It will change.
As a pro, and you've raced sort of both sides, the clean side and the dirty side, who's the most feared competitor or the best racer? You talk about racing, but who's your favourite racer as a pro?
Oscar Freire. He's just class. And even with us amongst the pros, it's widely acknowledged and recognised that he was clean during everything. It's kind of this kind of sort of weird kind of Chinese whispers thing that everyone says, Oscar was clean through his whole career, and he never said no, never kind of, he just, like Moncoutier didn't have Oscar's mentality. Oscar was very focused, he was a winner, but took his decisions. Moncoutier was very happy being himself. Oscar won 3 world championships, won Milan-San Remo, was green jersey in the Tour, did it all through knowing the people around him were doping, and just weathered the storm and got on with it, and just class to the bone.
Not Vinokurov.
He's my favourite racer.
See?
David, just a quick one. You've kind of seen with the World Tour that the races are going more global. You've got Oman, you've got Beijing, but there seems to be a few more races, the smaller races dying out. And it goes back to the sponsorship question, I suppose, with the sponsors disappearing and the smaller Italian races and Spanish races going. Is there a reason as to why this is happening? And do you think under the previous regime of the UCI, going wider global was a good decision?
Yeah, but it's basic economics. Cycling was very much based on people doing it as a hobby. Even the sport had so many races. My early career, we would just race like hell. I could do a whole season in Spain, but the whole thing was funded by TV and by the government. Every single race I would do, so I could do the whole season in Spain, and it was on primetime TV live every day. And it wasn't economically viable. It was always just that it was part of the culture. And a lot of the races in Europe have been like that. And the more it's been an excuse, if you like, it's been a reason, all the doping scandals for people to kind of lift their races. They don't get the sponsors anymore because it wasn't all boys network. It was just, it had been going on for 40 years, 50 years, 60 years. You'd find a sponsor. And we had so many pro teams as well, and so the base of our pyramid was so big, and the base of our pro pyramid was so big. It was good, but there were so many underpaid guys and so many races that were on a shoestring every year. So it's horrible, but it's kind of natural that we're kind of whittling it all down to it being an elite sport. Because in many ways, it hasn't been an elite sport for a long time. It's been a traditional sport. It's we can talk about there being a boom in British cycling over here, but the racing scene is reducing massively. We've just lost four of our best teams in the UK this year. At the end of this year, they withdrew sponsorship because we do not have a racing culture in the UK. We have a participation culture, which is great, and we have a very high elite level, which is magnificent. Now, we have the opposite in Europe, where it is a racing culture. It's just part of the... It's like cricket on greens in summer. It's just they're used to it, and kermesses in around the local village. The village fete is a kermesse, it's a bike race in Belgium. And in Holland, it's just their national sport. It's something they've grown up with. We haven't grown up with that. We haven't grown up with racing. So in many ways, they're now reducing their ridiculous level of races to what is actually an economically viable. Like everything in life, everything's being stripped down now. There's no room for kind of just doing something because it's traditional. Everyone's doing it because it has to reach beyond the bottom line. And that's what's happening with cycling.
Quick question about the Armstrong film that I've seen bits and pieces on the internet. But I just wondered if you could sort of maybe give us like an insight. Do you think it's going to tell anything different? Do you think it's going to be like a fair sort of a fair representation of what's happened? And
yeah, I'm a cycling consultant of the film, so kind of the buck stops with me if the cycling stuff is bad, which is a bit of a worrying responsibility. But the director, Stephen Frears, is very much a director. He's a storyteller who loves stories about people and the human condition. So the reason he kind of fell in love with the idea of doing this film was because he found the idea that our world existed. He stumbled across it last December reading an article in a magazine, a reviewer of The Secret Race, and was like, I did not know this existed. You know, you hear about Lance, but the kind of the depth of what was going on is, if you think about it, is quite strange. It's a massive kind of subculture and this wonderful kind of story of kind of the human condition, people making mistakes and people being feted. And so I think very much the tone of the film will be about Lance as a man and other people's responsibility and all of us looking at ourselves and saying, we kind of all let this happen to a certain degree. So I think it will be good. I have a lot of... I have 100% trust in Stephen Frears. I think he will do cycling justice, and I think he will be fair about Lance Armstrong. Now, whether that's good or not, I don't know, but I think it will be fair.
Do you mind me asking where your phenomenal drive and determination comes from? You mentioned you started at 18. Was it like that at 15? Was it like that at 10? Because it's... almost sort of superhuman drive and determination.
No, I don't. No, it's not. I don't think it is in the slightest. I was saying to my mum today, it's like I was explaining to somebody, one of the reasons I've been so good at pro cyclists is I'm so good at being lazy. I'm so good at doing nothing. It's like all pro cyclists you meet, they move slowly, they're chilled out. I mean, they're switched on when they need to be. But I think that's what elite pro cyclists, they learn to just kind of save energy. And they just, but then at the same time, they then go berserker at times. But my drive, if anything, it comes from just my parents. I think growing up in an environment where my dad was military and my mum has always been incredibly ambitious and intellectually curious, and I grew up around books and discipline and kind of I grew up. I was very much, it's a lot of genetic and a lot of it's nurture, I think.
Never mind the Vuelta, David. Tour of Britain. That's what it's all about. I honestly think you should ride that. You know, that little race in Spain can do whatever it does, okay? You know as well as I do, the Tour of Britain organisers will design you a course fitted to your requirements. They did it to Wiggins, and at the third time of asking, he finally got round to bloody winning it. Come and spend a glorious week racing around such wonderful places as Honister Pass, Peebles, North Wales and the rest of it, and get a sense of what you've meant, particularly over the last 4 or 5 years, to the British cycling public instead of going to Spain, please.
Thank you, Ned. that does make me think about it. There's this kind of that double kind of, I want to remember my last season as being a racer. I don't want to go and do a glory tour. It's like it's my last time to race my bike. I've thought about it. It could be an easy option or a nice option. Come to do Tour of Britain and maybe be feted and have a lovely, glorious sign-off. But I want my last race to be me racing, like doing the Vuelta, which was the race even during my doping period was my favorite race because everyone was so nice to me. And I was allowed to race my bike in Tour de France and all the other races I did. I had team responsibilities. I had all the sponsor and media responsibilities. And because I was on a French team, I get the Tour of Spain. And my sponsor companies, they didn't care. I was just allowed to race my bike and I didn't have to deal with anybody. And so Tour of Spain is kind of my race that reminds me of my love for pro cycling. And I kind of want to finish with my love for pro cycling and not go around and kind of wallowing in kind of egotistical kind of, I don't know. I want to race my bike. That's what I want to do. So,
you say you love cycling and you love racing. Do you still love it? Like win the Giro this year when the weather was horrendous? And as a percentage of when you go out and you have to train every day, what percentage of those days do you actually get up in the morning and think, Christ, I really don't want to go out and do that?
Kind of a lot, man. It's always been like that. It's always been a kind of, oh, fuck, I've got to go and do this. Then you get out, and then it's like, it's great. But all my teammates will say, this is the weirdest thing for me, because even at the Giro this year, come back, and it's like, all my pro teammates, they all consider me to be the one guy on the team that loves bad weather. It's like, bad weather for me is not a problem, never has been. It's like, I kind of love it. I've always raced at my best when it's horrible. I just kind of find it much more fun. It's much more of a challenge. You can use skill, it's not just purely physical. You can use technique and stuff and resilience and choice of clothes. My rain bags are works of art. Honestly, they're works of art. It's like, it's just all about preparation. And
one of the sections in your book I enjoyed was about Philippe Gaumont, and I know it's very sad what happened in his life, but I also read he was very friendly with Vandenbroek, and the two of them got up to major pranks before races, but then went on to attack and make them very lively. Do you think modern cycling, with the new sort of Sky mentality, has changed for the better or for the... obviously, the drugs are not better. But do you think there are fewer characters in the sport, and therefore it's a little less interesting for the viewer?
I mean, maybe Gaumont and VDB aren't the best examples of characters. I mean, the tragedy about those two were they were smart, incredibly charismatic guys who got wrapped up in drugs. Like, if you met VDB, he was just the loveliest man. Could just dance around languages and just make you feel incredible. And Gaumont the same when he's on fire. Couldn't dance around languages. But he was, but he could be incredibly charismatic and caring. But the two of them just got wrapped up in this vortex of drugs. So if they were around today, they'd probably be phenomenal cyclists and interesting characters. But it's a tightrope between being kind of interesting and too interesting. And they went a bit too far. And I think the sport at the moment is they still exist. Look at Sagan, incredible. And look at even on Sky, you got G. He's a lovely character. And even Chris, he's like, he doesn't come across much, but Froome Dog's got such a wonderful story and he's such a lovely guy. But maybe because the environment for him to win the Tour de France and do his things, he has to shut everything down. But you spent time with Chris. He's wonderful. The stories he can tell you. But he's, in order to succeed at that level now, you have to close everything down. And it doesn't quite work with being interesting, because then you have to talk with things that don't help your performance. So I think they do exist, but it's like I was saying before, the sport's just going through a transitional period now, and it will come out of it, and I think in 5 years or so, it will once again, everyone will be very secure in what they're doing, sponsors will be very secure. I mean, we're very lucky in that we have Garmin and Sharp as our sponsors, and Sharp are amazing. It's like they've come in as a kind of late sponsor through everything, stood by us, and believe in our team's eccentricity, and also our drive for like our tech drive. It's not just about stories. They're kind of, so it does exist that sponsors like eccentricity. Some don't, but that goes down to our team boss. So each team is very representative of its team boss and its sponsors. We have sponsors that love kind of it being a bit interesting.
I got a question for the racer in you. One of my standout memories from this year's Tour de France was on the Champs-Élysées. I think you spent about two laps around about 100 metres in front of the peloton all on your own, position that most of the cyclists in the room will be quite envious of. I'm just wondering if you can describe how it feels to be in that position. Is it exhilarating? Is it scary? Are you in a world of pain?
I mean, I think about that, especially when I was doing the film and working with other guys, and realizing how weird it was that I could do that. Because I told all my teammates I was going to do it. I said, I'll be in the break in the Champs. Don't worry about it. We're sorted. And I was such a gimp on the way there. I was so, because I crashed on the Friday and I was in a groin strain and I was just a mess and I was whinging to everybody. And I was convinced I wouldn't, I was like, I'm not going to be able to fulfill my bet to my teammates. And I was so angry at myself and I couldn't even get up the little climb through Paris. And then we got to the Champs and all of a sudden I was like, I started to like just kind of sniff it and think I'm doing it. And I started to feel better and it was all mental. It was nothing physical. Then kind of I just kicked in and was like, no, I can do this. And I read the break and I found it. And then I had the technique of being able to stay in the gutter. But it was all very focused. I was fully aware of what was going on. But the kind of now looking back at it and realizing that I was going around the Arc de Triomphe on my own and then going down that gutter. I remember coming down each time on that gutter and I was literally, because it's only that big, the gutter. And you kind of know, I got the TV motorbike there. Everybody's watching this. Because it's like, because you clip your pedal or you go slightly and it all goes pear-shaped and it would be the most horrifyingly embarrassing thing of my whole career. But coming down, so come off the Arc and I go straight into the gutter on the downhill and you have the gendarmes standing there on the curb and their feet are sticking out and their bodies there, their arms folded. And I was brushing them, like each time, just brushing them. And I was like, and it felt just kind of so, and I was so focused on that kind of little area and brushing them. And they were moving slightly back each time, and I was moving slightly further in each time, so I kept kind of brushing them. And it was just, I was just disappeared into this tiny little bubble where I was fully aware of what was going on, and I could see, and I knew the tactics, and I knew they'd hold me there now for like for 20 minutes because it stopped anyone else attacking. So they were just there, and the breakaways dropped away. And when I was on, and it was just, and I come round, and I remember every time I come down, and I've done it so many times, you come through the corner and you go down the tunnel before you do the comeback. And in the tunnel, there are all these firemen, friends, like underneath. And they're all like, Allez, Miller, just the firemen downstairs, like the underneath. And then I pop back out, and it's like silence. You know, always lovely firemen. I'd pop back out, and you come into this wall of sound on Rivoli. And it was just, and there it was just kind of like, I'm on my own, and Champs-Élysées stage, the Tour de France, and you come down, and the width of the avenue is the width of this room, and you sit in the middle, and it was just like cacophony everywhere. And I could remember fully appreciating all of it, thinking, this is just, don't forget this. And it was so, it was kind of a very much, something that will stay with me forever, those are the things where I think that's why I'm a pro cyclist. I don't need to win races. I can have experiences that nobody else ever gets to do.
That was a good last question. It was a great last answer. And I think that answer explains, articulates why, you know, this would be such a wonderful film. And if you can convey this that kind of experience, then I think we'd all really, really enjoy it. So it remains for me to just thank everybody for coming. As I said, we could have sold this out several times. Thanks, Finlay and Scottish Documentary Institute for organising it. And thank you very much, David.
The Cycling Podcast with humansinvent.com. Innovation, craftsmanship and design.